Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Charles Hugh Smith. He's author, leading global finance blogger, and philosopher. America's philosopher, we call him. He's the author of several books on our economy and society, including A Radically Beneficial World, Automation, Technology, and Creating Jobs for All, Resistance, Revolution, Liberation, A Model for Positive Change, and The Nearly Free University and the Emerging Economy. Also recently a book called Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. His blog of twominds.com is one of CNBC's top alternative finance sites. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Yes, indeed. And likewise, thought today would do a focus on the what is on everybody's mind, and that is the coronavirus. And specifically, actually, what its effects are on tightly global bound systems, the whole fragility of the financial system and the economy, the financial markets, all of that. Your initial thoughts?
Yeah, well, that's a great topic, Richard. And of course, we're always interested in talking about financial repression. And of course, we're seeing ramped up financial repression as the central bank's response to the coronavirus. But to talk about the tightly bound systems, I think that's a very good place to start, because unless you're in the supply chain, corporate, you know, global corporate supply chain, or know people who are, the average consumer might not be aware of how the system has been optimized over the last 20 years since China entered the WTO, and where the supply chains have been stripped of redundancy and so-called just-in-time manufacturer delivery and inventory has taken place to strip away all the extraneous costs to maximize profits, right? And so as a result, there's these systems are extremely, in system speak, we would say they're extremely tightly bound. Like, that means that instead of having a dozen suppliers around the world for a component, you have one supplier or maybe two suppliers, but they're in the same country. And so if that one component gets disrupted, then it disrupts your entire supply chain, because you don't have any redundant sources, and you also don't have enough inventory because that costs money, and so that was optimized away. So I think we're seeing in this so-called supply shock, the systems level understanding is we're now going to have to pay the price for stripping away all the redundancies in the system to optimize profits.
And so from that, do you see rising inflation based on this supply shock?
Yeah, I think you and I were speaking about that briefly before we started recording. It seems impossible not to have price increases that either – you have to find second or third sources that are not the cheapest. So you're going to have to pay the going price, or you might actually have to pay a premium, because that supplier may only provide 20% of the components globally. And so if they can be running, you know, two or three shifts and get provide a little bit more than they did before, but they're not going to be able to, you know, crank out 100% of demand. And so therefore you're going to have to pay a premium, not just a little bit higher, but possibly an extreme premium if you want to keep your production going. Also, if you're going to move your supply chain, or start up a second factory somewhere, that's extremely capital intensive, right? I mean, there's a lot of, not only does it take time, but it costs a lot of money. So, there's no cheap way to restore redundancy and loosely bound systems, you know, there's just no cheap way to do it. So yeah, that, and those prices are going to ripple through the economy for some time. That's the other thing we have to realize is right now, retailers like Amazon or Walmart, you know, they're burning through their inventory on hand, which they've already paid for. So they can keep prices low. But once these supply shock price increases come up, then corporations have no choice but to raise prices because they've already done everything within their power to keep prices low, including shrinkflation, you know, which we've talked about before, where, you know, all the items, all the cold cereal boxes has shrunk by 30%, right? Mm-hmm. To keep the price the same. So there's no more tricks. They're going to just have to raise prices.
Right. Because if I'm sitting here and I need a part for my cell phone, in the old days, it would be, you know, China perhaps providing that at a low cost. But now probably have to look to have it done, you know, locally at a much higher labor rate, you know, with the higher labor rates in the U.S. relative to China. So it's going to cost much higher, especially if they have to build a plant from scratch, as you just mentioned. So for the supply shock will likely result in, you know, rapidly rising inflation, high levels of inflation. At the same time, there's demand shock, right? Because now that all of this is happening, the travel industry is devastated. People are no longer buying, you know, plane tickets or less so, and going places that, you know, and travel destinations, hotels, hospitality industry. So, you know, with less buying, it's basically slowing the economy down as well. So we have a sort of stagflation developing or accelerating with rapidly decelerating economic activity and rapidly increasing pricing, consumer pricing at the same time.
Right. And, you know, one of the elements in that demand shock that I think is poorly understood or doesn't receive a lot of media coverage is the psychology of these kinds of traumas, if you will. So it's like the psychology of buying and borrowing money to buy stuff is depending on confidence, right? We have to have a certainty and a level of confidence in the future, in our future income and the stability of our lives, right? And so if there's a loss of confidence in the future or we feel uncertainty, our psychology changes from sort of expansive, well, sure, let's go on a vacation or I can afford a new appliance or a new vehicle, to kind of a circle the wagons, like, well, why don't we just kind of pull in our horns here and lay low, you know, until we have a greater sense of psychological certainty, right? And a renewed confidence in the future. And so I think that psychology is key. And we see it in markets, right? Because, you know, markets are really reflect human psychology of, you know, famously fear and greed, and they will flip on a dime, right? Mm. So, but consumers also respond to that same psychology.
Mm-hmm. So that seems to be one effect here. Another one is the increase in state intervention. So looks like there will likely be a significant increase in state intervention in all aspects of life, the economy, financial markets. So this means everything from potential suspension of mark-to-market pricing, you know, something that happened in the financial crisis. We may see government controls on pricing, price fixing, and just overall more control by governments on banks to make sure that interest rates are kept artificially low to, you know, to help out consumers and borrowers. There may be a force or an encouragement for companies to continue with cash flow, even though it's non-existent in paying salaries, compensation to employees. Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's a terrific topic, Richard, and I'd like your views on the ultimate effects of the consequences of that kind of increased financial repression in terms of central banks encouraging lenders to open the spigots and lower interest rates. And we can see some of that in apparently there was a bump up in mortgage refinances because you know, mortgage rates dropped. So there may be some benefit to the consumer with that. But I guess I'm thinking that the most effective intervention or fiscal stimulus might be what Hong Kong did, which was just simply to print and give away money to each household, right? Because that's kind of a tried and true way of maintaining demand. And it wouldn't surprise me if other nations might pursue that same Hong Kong model if they end up suffering, you know, a severe demand shock, right?
Yeah.
Which as you say, could come from layoffs, right? And so then what are those people going to do? In the U.S. and the advanced economies, there's a whole system of unemployment, but that system is not in place in second world and developing nations. So, that we may see massive fiscal stimulus just to keep demand from collapsing.
Yeah. I mean, certainly we're already seeing monetary stimulus that doesn't appear to be working. Had the Fed just lower interest rates, didn't seem to have much effect, maybe initially, but then it sort of wore off quickly. So there's likely to be more of that, more monetary stimulus, lowering of interest rates, additional QE, quantitative easing programs, and fiscal stimulus. But the question is, will it work, you know, in this type of environment?
Yeah, and I'm interested in your thoughts because, you know, we've talked and you've had many, you know, super knowledgeable guests talk about the diminishing returns on financial repression, right? Like keeping interest rates low and kind of flooding the financial markets with liquidity. And there, it's clear, and we all know it, we all know this and talk about it. There's a massive disconnect between this financial sort of stimulus and intervention and the real world economy, right? That the central banks keep increasing their financial repression, but the transmission to the real economy is actually quite weak and may actually be diminishing. For example, S&P 500 corporations operating income has been flat for like 3 or 4 years. And in that same time, the S&P 500 stock index has gone up 60%. So I think that's kind of what we're talking about here is if they ramp up their financial repression, is it going to have a positive effect in the real world economy? And if it is going to have an effect, is it going to be enough to counter the supply and demand shocks we're talking about?
And if it doesn't, which appears to be what could happen, this could actually be the catalyst that we've been talking on for a while, and that is the loss of confidence in government and central banks, you know, as a result of all of this, you know, the coronavirus may be the catalyst that actually accelerates that process. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's a terrific topic, Richard, because it was sort of like the way that we were talking about it. It was sort of like a pile of dry wood just waiting for a match, right? Mm-hmm. In other words, the diminishing returns, the enormous expansion of leverage and debt, all of these things have increased the brittleness and fragility of the global financial system. And so, I guess trying to look at for a silver lining in this is, If the central banks drop rates to zero or negative, and they start up QE, start buying bonds and equities directly, and they keep those markets up, but the real world economy tanks, right? That unemployment shoots up because waiters, waitresses, baristas, people that work in all these industries that require public gatherings, you know, there may be mass layoffs if those industries get hit, because small business typically does not have the, as you say, the financial resources to pay their employees months on end. I'd say it's for many businesses, it's a matter of a week or two, and then that's it. They're out of working capital to pay their employees. So there could be mass unemployment and a huge decline in demand, even as the stock market continues rising because of this incredible stimulus. But that's not really going to solve the real world economic difficulties. So if there's a loss of faith in the central banks and their policies, and the markets end up rolling over, the positive thing that I see the potential for is to clean out all the deadwood that's been piling up for 12 years of financial repression, by which I mean zombie corporations that are not really operating at, you know, generating profits. They're just simply borrowing more money. Over-leveraged speculation, over-leveraged consumers and households, over-leveraged corporations, you know, that have depended on a huge, you know, junk debt, if you will. So cleaning out all that deadwood would actually restore some, you know, vibrancy and flexibility to the system. So that could be one silver lining to the loss of faith in central banks.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Let's talk about that. The positive silver lining aspect. So that would be one. And to your point in your recent book, Pathfinding Our Destiny, Preventing the Final Fall of Our Democratic Republic. In that book, you emphasize movement to more local and decentralized systems. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's a great topic because, you know, speaking specifically as an example of using China, because it is the workshop of the world, as the saying goes, that the Chinese have made a big push into AI and semiconductors and a lot of advanced technologies in an effort to, you know, move their way up the value chain, right, and not be dependent on assembly and lower value manufacturing. And so there's, before this coronavirus hit, there was a lot of people had the opinion that the supply chain could never move out of China because it had too many technological components within China that you couldn't source elsewhere. And I think that what's happening, and it may be a nascent or emerging trend, but obviously, corporations are going to be looking at this situation of being completely dependent on a supply chain in one country, and they're going to start realizing that there's a potential cost to that and the coronavirus just being one example. So people say, well, they can't move the supply chain out of China. Well, there's always a way to move a supply chain, right? If you don't have a choice, you find a way, right? I mean,
yeah.
So, where the supply chain moves, I mean, clearly there's already been movement to Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, Southeast Asia, Mexico, and so we can kind of foresee, I think, with some certainty, an expansion of alternative supply chains around the world, but certainly localized in the U.S. or North America. It brings it home, reduces transportation costs and time. And so there's benefits to that, that, may be intangible to some degree. In other words, like, one of the points in my book that I talk about is that, you know, not all costs and benefits are tangible, and many of them are very difficult to price. And they're not always in the price, right? The so-called externalities, and also just how do you price the certainty that, you know, if you've got your key component suppliers right in North America, you're going to find some way to get those components to your assembly plant in a way that's not possible if your supply chain's, you know, stranded 6,000 miles away, right? Yeah. So it's hard to, that may not be in the price, but it's certainly part of the benefit of relocalization.
Yeah. And I mean, also the whole cost issue needs to be analyzed, because I mean, there's certainly a lot of cost in that transportation from long distances, and also associated tariffs levels through different countries. And especially, you know, with the more recent introduction of robotics process automation and manufacturing using more technology with less human labor. So, you know, that would not be as costly as in the old days of the manufacturing world. So, you know, that would need to be looked at, right? I think the overall cost equation.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And we might see a move that Chinese companies that are automating their factories in China, they might have incentives to expand their production in North America or other areas. In other words, using their own homegrown technology, if you will, and their patents, but not keeping production in China, you know, spreading it around the world, and as a way of sort of hedging their own bets on being dependent on China assembly. And as you say, if you're going to build an automated plant, the labor component is a relatively modest percentage of the total cost of that, right? Most of it's capital costs. And so it doesn't really matter if you will, where you're going to put the plant, if labor is like a 5% of the total cost structure. So,
right. Exactly. And one thing that is also a positive aspect of potentially from fiscal stimulus, at least initially, would be the idea of fiscal stimulus going into new technologies to help develop the overall development, manufacture, and distribution of vaccines quicker and more effectively. So, and also in drugs, you know, that can provide some antiviral immunity boost at the same time. So these type of areas, some funds going into biotech, healthcare, medical research, particularly in the vaccine funnel, meaning, you know, how can you develop a vaccine that is faster? Because, you know, this is just a wave, you know, there'll be likely other viruses coming, other pandemics. So, to the extent that we can minimize the time it requires to develop that vaccine, and also, do the manufacturing and distribution once it is developed. So your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that is definitely a silver lining. And in fact, we could even say that, you know, the difficulty in the tests, that the first test the CDC developed were apparently defective, or one component was defective. And there's obviously some problems with the testing around the world that, anecdotally, there's lots of media accounts of, you know, that the first test negative, the second test positive, third test negative, you know. So obviously there's room for improvement in developing rapid tests that would be more reliable than the PCR that they have now. So yeah, a lot of potential there. And you know, in terms of treatment too, if a vaccine isn't possible, then as you say, saving lives, you know, by being able to boost the immune response or that kind of thing. We can look at HIV that now, thanks to the cocktail, you know, that was developed, and now it's being manufactured really cheaply in India, so that it can be, you know, supplied to Africa, you know, at a very low cost. So obviously, in other words, it's not just a brand new technology, but if we can reduce the cost structure so that the world can actually afford these innovations, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a lot of room for improvement there, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And even Canada now is doing some leading research on developing an anti-coronavirus drug that actually leverages off quercetin, which is abundant in apple skins, grape skins, onions, you know, things that Canada makes as well. But the element that is common to that is quercetin, and which has antiviral properties. So there's a lot of research being done on that right now here in Canada.
Interesting. Well, you know, Richard, I don't know if you'll post it, but you know, I drew up a diagram and it's sort of a projection, if you will, of the rise of the COVID-19 virus, assuming it follows the parabolic curve that is typical for a novel, very contagious virus, right? Which is, and we actually have a lot of experience with that kind of very contagious virus. It's called the normal flu, right? I mean, it infects tens of millions of people in North America every year. And so this is apparently an even more contagious virus than the regular varieties of flu. So I think we can look ahead, and in my view, I think it's very early days to assume that this is controllable. And so I think we can anticipate a sort of false dawn where countries may kind of open their borders again and people get back to work and it's kind of brushed aside. But actually there's a huge reservoir of people, carriers that are asymptomatic. And so I think we could anticipate a second wave, which could be much larger, than the first wave. And so I am sort of cautious about people brushing this aside, saying, oh, well, you know, China's going to be, all production's going to be back at 100% at the end of March, and the virus is going to go away by April.
Oh, man.
I'm not so sure, because the two things that we know about this, when there's a huge number of things we don't know, but what we do know is it's very contagious, and it's spread by people with no symptoms. And so as I say on my blog, no data doesn't mean no virus. So I think we have to be very cautious about thinking that the effects are going to be modest. I think the effects could because of the brittleness and the fragility of the financial system we're talking about, I think there could be huge knock-on consequences here in the second half of the year. So
yeah. So what do you think the time frame could be for those last two phases in your chart? So what you have, second to last, is wave two outbreaks around the world, half measures fail, vaccine months away. And then the last one is the world finally awakens to the pandemic, global economy slides into depression.
Right. I'm kind of guessing that we're in March is the false dawn, and where everybody thinks this is, you know, that China's got it under control, and it's going to be limited. I think April and May is the second wave, when it explodes around the world, and then people realize this is uncontrollable by the normal means. And, you know, even in China, I've noticed that I haven't been able to find any news out of Western China. In other words, you know, China's a big country, and there's, you know, somewhere like 600 million people in the West. And I haven't heard any news about the virus or the impact or the epidemic there. And so it's kind of like there's this black hole, like, well, what's going on there? So yeah. It's real easy to kind of cherry pick data and go, well, Beijing is still virus free or whatever. But, you know, it's like that's not the whole country. So, and that's, I think, emblematic of the whole world, you know, that the small number of cases, I think, will explode in the second quarter. And then we'll have a better sense of whether it's controllable or not. And then people are hoping it dies back in summer because of the advanced, you know, the humidity and people are outdoors rather than confined inside enclosed spaces. And maybe the heat might diminish its contagiousness. But, you know, the history of other pandemics like the 1918 flu is that it reemerges in fall. And so there's we can't really say that even if it dies back in summer that it's all, we're done and it's over. That would be there would be no historical model for that claim. So we have to be careful that we may see it reemerge in the fourth quarter.
And do you see parallels between what's happening and what happened in the Spanish flu pandemic, 1918, 1919?
Well, it's we have to kind of go back to that model as the only sort of comparable virus, I think, in terms of its lethal, it's very lethal. The difference is that this the COVID-19 appears to be lethal for elderly and chronically ill people, where the 1918 flu actually killed a great number of healthy young people, and that made it quite devastating. But it's the projections are that this could kill a lot of people, and you could say, well, it's only the elderly, but if it's your elderly family member, you don't want them to get it, you know? So, that's one big difference. But as we know, the epidemiologists who've been following it, they're basically telling us it's not controllable. And Nassim Taleb put out a paper shortly after the outbreak became public, in which he sort of briefly sketched out the problem here is the more interconnected your system, the less ability do you have to control something like a contagious disease like this. And so you look at the global economy and it's super interconnected. You just look at the air travel and thousands upon thousands of flights daily crisscrossing the planet. And so his basic prescription was, if you want to lower the contagiousness of this, you're going to have to dramatically lower the connections in your system. And of course, that would mean killing off tourism, travel, and a lot of the global economy. So we seem to be, as a global economy, we seem to be unwilling to do that. So that means we're not really able to control the spread. That's my conclusion. Yeah.
But it may be aligned with what you've mentioned in your recent book in terms of a movement to more local and decentralized systems.
Yeah, right. And to kind of pare back the number of critical nodes, and have a looser system with more redundancy and more flexibility. So those will be positives. And although, just to make one final comment about the topic of the loss of confidence in institutions, that will be a devastating blow, because once you've lost confidence, it's very hard to restore that. It takes baby steps. And so if central banks lose control of the financial system and there's a loss of confidence in their policies, that is not going to be fixed, even if the virus dies back or comes under control. That loss of confidence is devastating in its own right, sort of what I've been calling a second order effect. So even if the virus gets under control, there could be consequences that are not so easily controlled. And I think loss of confidence would be number one.
Oh man, I need a drink, perhaps some red wine, which has quercetin and antiviral properties with the red grape skin. So, okay.
So, that sounds good to me too.
Great talking with you, Charles. Great insight as always. Thank you very much. We'll do it again.
Yeah, thank you, Richard, for letting me ramble on about this amazingly interesting and difficult topic.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Bernoulli. Today we have a very special guest, a first-time guest. He is Yossi Kaplan. He's a management consultant consulting to global companies, and he's also residing here in Toronto, Ontario, where we're doing this interview. He is a real estate agent here specializing in real estate investments. Welcome, Yossi.
Hi, Richard. Thank you so much for having me on your podcast. I really appreciate it.
Great. I thought we'd do a focus discussion on the coronavirus, specifically what's going on and what can be done at the home level, at your condo or home, in terms of preparation, packing lists, sanitizers, and also a global perspective about the New World Order. What is that? What does it mean? How do we change our way of life? Your perspective initially, Yossi?
Fantastic, Richard. Thank you. So yeah, there's three things I'd like to touch on. The first is how to prepare, at least how I prepare, and I suggest share with my friends. The second, how to make hand sanitizer, because you're going to need it. And the third is, of course, what I call the New World Order, how our society and government is going to change and how our lives are going to change as a result of this pandemic, call it whatever you like.
Great. Let's just jump right in. So you've actually come up with a number of items. You've come up with a recipe for doing your home sanitizer and also a 30-day condo supplies list. Can you elaborate?
Sure. Let's start with the supply list. The supply list you can find at condocorona.com, because I work in real estate, condocorona.com. And what it is a very simple one-page site where you can download free a three-day condo supply list. Now, when you download that list, it's completely anonymous. There's no tracking, and you do not need to register, so everyone can feel safe about downloading this list. Once you download, it'll just take you to a Dropbox, and you download the file. It's a PDF or XLS, whatever you prefer. And that list, which we'll link below, will include all your basic needs, at least all my basic needs, to get you started on packing. Now, I want to talk about there's two sections to the list. The first section is food, and the second section is the sanitary section. Really basic. I assume that you live in a condo. I assume that you have running power and water. If you don't have running power and water, that's a whole other topic. I'm not going to get into it right now. Within these two sections, the first section, the food section, has two parts. The first part is food that you can eat no matter what, means you do not need to cook it. And the second part is food that you do need to cook. And that's very important, because in case that we have a power failure, let's say everyone's sick, or there's a flash freezing storm, or whatever it is, some natural disaster or man disaster, it doesn't matter, you won't be able to cook. For that, all you need really is a bunch of canned food. And what I suggest, you buy organic food with BPA-free cans. And here at the 30-day condo supply, I have about 18 cans per person. I recommend things like bean, lentils, chickpeas, and so on. And then the second part is dry lentil, dry chickpea, the same thing but in dry. So obviously you can pack a lot of energy, a lot of calorie into a very small space, because we all live in tiny small spaces in the city. I know it, especially being a real estate agent, living in a condo, selling condos. And then you got items like energy bombs, like tahini, honey, oats, maple syrup, peanut butter, applesauce, jam, nuts, seeds, coffee, creamers, sweeteners, tea, sea salt, chocolate, and sauces. And of course, the second part is the sanitary stuff. So it's soap for your hands, soap for your body, soap for your laundry, sanitizers, alcohol to sanitize, peroxide, drop sheets, tape, all these things you need to block off your home and stay home for a few days if you need to.
Great. And I've always thought of the philosophy approach of increasing the distance between your exposure and your immunity effectiveness. So a lot of the items you have do both in some sense. And I also wanted to point out that there's some research even here in Canada with regard to looking at quercetin and derivatives of that in enhancing coming up with a drug that is highly potent based on that high concentration of quercetin-based derivatives that could help to be antiviral. So these quercetin essentially comes from apple peels, grape skins, onions. Those are some of the sources. And apparently those items have antiviral properties. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I'm no scientist, but hopefully it works. That's all I can say really about this topic. And you know, Richard, I think a lot of various solutions and resolutions will come as a result of these things. I never thought that about hand sanitizer or making hand sanitizer or making a juice that can heal you from any disease. But you know, part of this thing, which we'll see in the next part of this discussion, will be, how do we adapt as individuals and society to the nature of this pandemic.
Yes.
And using natural elements that are available to anyone everywhere is probably a great opportunity for us to go back to nature and to appreciate what we already have in front of us.
Do you see this development of a new world order as being long-term, or like what happens if just a vaccine is developed and then we go back to the old world order?
That's a really great question. That's a really great question, Richard. You know, it's hard to tell at this point, but my gut feel is that we've already passed that threshold. Maybe we'll jump right to the new world order section here. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I told people, look, this could be really serious, and maybe you should pack up a bit of food. And I got mostly ridiculed, laughed at, sarcasm, cynicism. But now people say, oh, can I have your list? Yeah, condocorona.com. So there's definitely a shift in the mindset. There's a shift in how people feel about the situation and themselves. And there's a lot of people are starting to ask questions about their governments and about their way of life. So am I safe? Are my children safe? Is my family safe? You know, every day we see more and more stories about, we just saw a story yesterday you sent me that, a security guard in an apartment building in Scarborough got infected. What does that mean to everyone coming in and out of the elevator in that building? And then people say, oh, well, that could happen to me. Maybe I'm that security guard, or I'm that neighbor that walked by the security guard, maybe handed me an envelope or asked me to some signs on for a package, handed me a pen, and then maybe attach my face after that. So the moment it starts to hit you on the individual level, the moment the pain is too great to bear on an individual level, that's the point where you start to make changes. That's the point where you really, you're hitting a wall of cognitive dissonance. And once you hit that wall of cognitive dissonance, you just lose all the notions you had before and you start asking real questions. Am I safe? And is my way of life is still the way it is? Will my way of life change? Will the way I think about life changes? And of course, the greatest question of all, did my government protect me? Have they disclosed to me everything they know? Are the numbers they give me are real? And you know, like, there's a lot of questions coming up this last couple of days. Why am I told that I do not need to wear masks or gloves, where clearly every single person is using masks and gloves, and even when they do, they get infected, okay? Why are they telling me the flu kills more, but obviously this thing kills 20 or 30 times more than flu? Probably if we see, you know, we see someone in a faraway country, even if they belong to some government, especially if it's a dictatorial government, and they get the disease, we go, whatever, you know. But if it's going to get hit home and it'll be a celebrity getting this thing, or a government person getting this thing, or a teacher, or someone that you know, or, you know, God forbid, anyone that you know, or yourself, then you're going to start asking really tough questions.
So, like, what do you see happening? I mean, is this going to be a long-term steady state situation, or do you see this new world order coming in cycles, like, maybe we get a biological pandemic, and then we go back to normal, and then we get another biological pandemic? Do you see this as being an ongoing type of new world order?
There's definitely no way back from here, because once you receive the information, once you open yourself to information you blocked to before, there's no going back. So there's no going back as a society. There's no going back on people. And maybe governments will change. You know, Richard, the dictatorial regimes around the world, they're doing a great job because they can actually tell everyone to stay home and do what they need to do. But at the same time, we don't know if the information that they've given us is true. And there's a lot of videos before they get banned or blocked that you see people falling down on the streets in all kinds of countries. If that's going to start to happen here, that's going to be a big deal. And then if you got blocked by MSM not reporting, or you're going to get blocked by Twitter, Google, Facebook, YouTube, whatever, then I think you'll see a major, major shift. And there's definitely no way back from there. The other thing is, you're going to ask the Canadian government, why have you allowed flights back and forth from China or even a flight that went from China to another place and then to Canada on the same plane, obviously not disinfected. Why have you allowed this for so long while knowing this? What have you known? Have you been in touch with the Chinese authorities? Have you been in touch with the Americans? Have you been in touch with the World Health Organization? Have you been in touch with the CDC? And I imagine a lot of investigations and public hearings happening once we get this situation stabilized.
Do you see this as a change from globalization? Do you see a trend towards more local-based economic activity? What are your thoughts on that?
100%. We are going to learn very, very quickly how to live in a community again, how to rely on each other and ourselves again, how to help each other, how to become better friends, how to become better neighbors, how to realize that we all have to work together in order to guarantee our survival. And it's funny, it's happening in 2020 where, you know, you can just go on your phone and food shows up. But, you know, somebody on Facebook said yesterday, well, I don't have to leave. I can just, you know, get Uber Eats. Well, have you thought of who handled your food and who delivered your food and what's the environment your food went through before you order it? Yeah. All right. What if these people are infected? What if somebody sneezed around and there's a particle and a virus just happened to land on my food which I just ate? What do I do? Who can I trust? So I think all these questions will rise and really shake the foundations on which our recent culture, and when I say recent culture, I mean internet, the last 20 years. So internet, globalization, anything to do with remote ordering. Really, you can get anything from anywhere. You just go to Amazon and you can get anything from anywhere within hours or days. All these things will have to be looked at, and I think there's no way back. I think we'll see way change. Still early to tell about globalization, but definitely there's already a lot of talk about supply chains and manufacturing and how can we really rely if we know that most of the ingredients in the meds are made in China, and all the disinfectants are made in China, and everything that you buy in Dollarama is made in China, and all the clothes you're wearing right now, from your socks to your underwear to your shoes, hat, shirt, everything is made in China. Shouldn't we start manufacturing here? So that is moving back into communal, moving back into regional. Also, there's a lot of talk about producing food by yourself. So how can I grow a bunch of food at home? How can I integrate complete vertical farms into buildings, or even better, build a vertical farm and integrate residential and commerce into the farm? So not force it into the condo building, but build a building that supplies food and people can live it in as well. So in addition, we're probably going to see the resurgence of small self-sustaining communities, which is really the basic of human living. You know, as humans, we used to live in little villages where the men would go hunt and the women would deal with the homestead, and then they come back home and everyone doing their work, and that's how we survive. So we may go back. I mean, obviously, we're not going to go hunt in the urban areas. We still have to do our thing. But I think there's going to be a definite shift in thinking and then in doing, in actual physical action, into communal and regional living.
Longer term, though, if that means more local-based production, wouldn't that be highly inflationary due to the labor rates here relative to other parts of the world? Do you see that happening, rising inflation as well as a declining standard of living? So is all of this, does that necessarily mean a decline in our standard of living and way of life? What are your thoughts?
This is an amazing question, Richard. I've been thinking about it a lot, and way of life is subjective. It's really how I look at it. It's only one or two generations ago that World War II happened. There's all kinds of wars all over the place. And, you know, we here in Canada, we're so spoiled and we really live in like a king could not even imagine living just 30 years ago. So we are as rich as we've ever been. So scaling back a way of life is really scaling back consumerism. Do we really need 20 pairs of socks? Do we really need a million pairs of shoes? Do we really need 500 pairs of sunglasses? And part of that cognitive dissonance for us as individuals and a society is to decide and understand what is important to me and what is really not important. So status symbols that are based on consumerism and material goods will probably dwindle down. I don't know if they'll die, but maybe the new status symbol will be health. The new status symbol will be being free of virus. The new status symbol would be having the special juice to clean my blood. And the new status symbol will be to eat well and not necessarily to be able to consume. And that, plus high cost of labor and transportation and possibility of infection, will at first phase probably likely, most likely, to bring prices up. When prices go up, it is followed by inflation, it is followed by contraction of consuming, but it's also followed by a psychological internalization process where I start thinking to myself, what's important to me? And the only thing that people can come up at the end is what's important for me is, of course, myself and the people close to me. So we're probably going into a huge storm here, massive, massive storm that we don't want to look at, but it's going to be in our faces, like it or not. But a lot of good can come out of it. A lot of questions can come out of it, especially towards government. You know, have you known about these things? How long have you known about it? What have you done about it? If you've known about it, why haven't you stopped for it? What are our doctors doing? Let's say I need a surgery tomorrow. Is it safe for me to go to the hospital? They're going to cut me open, and then I can get infected even worse. So, yes, everything will have to be looked at, and consumerism may come down a bit, and cost of living will come up a bit. A lot of people, thousands and thousands, probably millions, are going to lose their jobs. You know, the airline, the tourist industry, the consumer goods, any other manufacturing stuff that you don't actually need, you can consume it because it's fun and you have the free money. But, you know, do you need 3 cups of coffee a day? Or can you just do the one? So if the cup of coffee costs $3 a day, and, you know, with the tip cost me $10 or $12, that's fine. But if the cup of coffee now costs $6 a day, maybe I'll just have one.
Wow, that's great insight into what's happening and also some very helpful information, ideas, what to do at home in your condo, and perspectives on the New World Order. Thank you very much, Yossi. How can our listeners learn more about your work?
Okay, Richard, the first thing, go to condocorona.com and download the list. Again, it's free and there's no login or tracking required. Just download, use it. The second, I'll quickly mention how to make hand sanitizer. There's two types of hand sanitizer, with alcohol and without. I literally went to Google, and it wasn't my recipe, and I typed in natural homemade hand sanitizer, and the formula is very simple. And it's on my YouTube, too, youtube.com/YossiKaplan. It's linked through Condo Corona. All you got to do is you take a bunch of alcohol, 99% isopropyl, the regular one you buy for $5 at the supermarket if you can still get it. That's the main, that's your main ingredient. Add a few drops of vitamin E, add a few drops of lavender oil, and add a few drops, maybe 10 or 20 drops of tea tree oil. Shake it and you're good. If you want to make it non-alcoholic, simply replace the alcohol with aloe jelly. Aloe jelly, you get at the health food store. And add witch hazel, which serves as an antiseptic, as a natural antiseptic to alcohol. And that's about it. You know, the most important thing is to be alert, be smart about everything you do, and take care of each other.
Great. Thank you very much, Yossi.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.